Hello, everybody, and welcome to Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. I'm your host, DJ Rare. How is everybody doing today? I hope everybody's doing well. I hope everybody's keeping safe. There are a lot of fires going on right now in the North Bay and all over our state. So I am praying for everybody's safety. I am praying for our firefighters. I hope that they can control and contain all the fires and that all this can be over soon so we can start to recover and rebuild. But let's begin our show for today. Today we're going to talk about the coronavirus and the disability community. Because despite the fact that things are somewhat normal since the initial outbreak of COVID-19 in March, the virus is still very much alive. It's still very much alive despite all the things going on in our nation right now that are distracting us from that fact. The virus is still very much alive, and the U.S. is reporting 7.5 million cases and more than 200,000 deaths. So it's clear that we still have a long way to go before all this is over. As we have seen in the last couple of months, we are all at risk of getting COVID-19. It doesn't matter if you are young or you are old. You still have a risk of contracting COVID-19. But as we all know too, those with underlying medical conditions and the elderly are at a higher risk of getting this virus because they are more vulnerable to it. Because of this reason, when the initial outbreak happened in March, this population was greatly impacted by it. When this all started, you know, we all lost a lot. You know, we lost our jobs, we lost school, we were stuck at home. We all had to quarantine. But for many individuals in the disability community and with underlying medical conditions, they lost access to their medical care because, you know, the hospitals were focused on COVID patients, not on regular patients. And because many doctors' offices were shut down and the appointments were canceled. And even today, you know, that things are somewhat normal, appointments with your doctors are not really available unless they're an emergency. So you can't just be like, oh, I need to go see my doctors. No, because they are booked full, you know, because everybody's trying to get an appointment. And even then, you know, they're not doing in-person anymore. And then for other individuals, when all this started, there was a huge risk of them losing their caregiver or their nurse's aide simply because of the shelter-in-place orders and because of the social distancing guidelines. You know, a lot of people, you know, because we did not know about the virus and how it was transmitted, a lot of people lost their caregivers. And also because, you know, we were trying to take care of each other, you know. We didn't want to pass it down from the patient to the caregiver or the caregiver to the patient. So that was a huge risk when all this happened. And even today, it's still a huge risk. Because if the caregiver for some reason gets sick with COVID-19 or the patient gets sick, then that means that that patient is not going to have access to their caregiver or their nurse or any other home services for their medical care. And, you know, with a virus that has put so much strain on our healthcare system, we all know that there's a shortage of caregivers and nurses available because everybody is at the hospital treating patients with COVID-19. Another risk, another impact of the pandemic towards the disability community was the not only the stress and the anxiety, which we were all feeling, but also the isolation. A lot of us, you know, we isolated ourselves from our families and from our friends. We took the shelter in place very seriously, and even today, we are still taking it seriously, and we are still in quarantine for the most part, which is hard because it seems that everybody else is, you know, the rest of the world is coming out, is outside while we are still in quarantine. And that sometimes is a little frustrating because a lot of people, you know, they say to us, oh, you're living in fear, you know? You're still at home and doing the quarantine, and you're living in fear of this virus. And I'm like, that is so selfish, you know? That's so selfish of people to say that we're living in fear, that we're scared. Because that's not it. That's not true. We're not living in fear. We're just taking the necessary precautions to take care of ourselves and to take care of others, you know? To take care of all those around us. Because I don't know about you, but I want to live, right? And they're saying that there's a virus out there. You know, my doctor is telling me, be careful, follow these rules. It's because they know something, and there's a virus still going up out there. And I want to take care of myself, and I want to take care of others. So saying that to someone with an underlying medical condition or an elderly person is very selfish, it's very mean, because this virus is not a you problem, you know? It's a we problem. We all need to work together, right? To find a solution and to take care of each other. But another thing that this virus has also taught us, or this pandemic, I should say, is that the things that we thought we couldn't do before are possible now. Before this pandemic, you know, we weren't able to work remote or go to school remotely, but now we are. Now we are learning and working remotely. We are doing telehealth, seeing our doctors through video consults, and many services and procedures are being done online. And I think that this is so funny because before the pandemic, all these things were impossible to do. They were impossible to accommodate to people. But now, because of the virus, because of COVID, for some reason, somehow, this was all made possible, right? And it's ironic and, you know, funny because the disability community has been fighting these issues of trying to make things more accessible and more accessible by being able to do remotely. And it has taken a virus for all this to become possible. And it's not even because of the disability community. It's because the able community needed all this stuff. They needed to keep working. They needed to keep going to school. They needed their services. So all this was made possible. So yeah, this pandemic has definitely taught us that we can be adaptable, that we can be flexible, and that we can be a little bit more accessible to not just the able-bodied community, but also the disability community. So yeah, this moment was definitely bittersweet. That, you know, it's happened after all this time, after fighting for so long, but it's a win. It's a win nonetheless, and we're gonna take it, and we're gonna be happy about it, and hopefully we can continue to work on becoming a more accessible world and a more accessible society, not just for the able-bodied community, but to all the communities in our nation. And please Don't forget the 3 W's. Wash your hands, wear your mask, and watch your distance. This is Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. I'm your host, DJ Rare. Hey everybody, welcome back to Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. I'm your host, DJ Rare. Let's continue our conversation on COVID-19 and the disability community. In my previous segment, I spoke to you guys about the challenge that many individuals in the disability community are facing with the current COVID-19 pandemic. One of the challenges that individuals with underlying medical conditions are facing is that they lost access to their medical care. As we all know, when the pandemic began, many hospitals, they focused all their attention on COVID patients, as they should, but also a lot of doctors, they had to shut down all their clinics and consultation offices, so a lot of patients who were not COVID patients had to cancel all their appointments and had to cancel their medical procedures, surgery, and all that stuff. A lot of people had to, they lost they lost access to their medical care. There was just no way around it. And even today, access to medical care is minimal at best because doctors are not seeing you face to face unless it's an emergency. Not only because of COVID-19, but also because they're all booked, because everybody, now that we're open, everybody, everybody wants to see their doctors, so they're booked. Like for me, I tried to make an appointment the other day for my pulmonologist, and the next available appointment for him is, at the end of December, early January. So, unless it's not an emergency, your doctor is not going to see you. But in my previous segment, I also spoke about all the good things that came out of the pandemic, such as the fact that many institutions are now more adaptable and flexible. So, we are obviously learning remotely, and we are also working remotely. But for the healthcare institution, that is also being done remotely. So a lot of patients are receiving their medical care remotely via Zoom. Which is good, right? It's really good because we all need access to our medical care. But this is all thanks to a new policy that the Trump administration created to remove the barriers to medical care during the public health emergency of COVID-19. Now, this policy, which was created only for the current pandemic, the current emergency, is called the Community Home Health and Telehealth Policy. With this policy, patients are provided with telehealth services. Now, what is telehealth services? Or what is telehealth? Telehealth, or telemedicine, refers to the exchange of medical information from one side to another through electronic communication to improve a patient's health. So, this means basically that even if you see multiple doctors at different hospitals, they are able to have access to your medical records electronically, but also that you are able to have a consultation with your doctor virtually through Zoom or through a video conference or video chat web-based application that allows you to see your doctor obviously through a video chat, because you are not able to do it in person, because like I said, they are booked, or they can only see you for emergency. But under the communication community, under the community home health and telehealth policy, patients are able to utilize essential home health services that were unavailable before the pandemic. For example, this means that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid has temporarily changed the definition of homebound to include individuals who have a condition that puts them at greater risk of COVID-19, making it possible for these patients to receive medical care, home health benefits. So that means that those services, those home health services that were unavailable before the pandemic, are now available to patients who have a condition that makes them, that puts them at a higher risk of COVID-19, because, like I said, Medicare and Medicaid have temporarily changed the definition of homebound. Before, it was only available to patients who were obviously homebound and who were unable to go out, which is, people don't realize is that's a lot of individuals in the disability community, or those who have, you know, all those who have underlying medical conditions. Sometimes we are homebound and we are unable to go places, to go to our doctors, because one, we have mobility issues. Two, we don't have transportation. You know, there's a lot of things that can prevent you from receiving in-person medical care. Under this policy, it also ensures that patients can continue to have in-home infusions or procedures. So for those who previously had home infusion, or home dialysis, or let's say physical therapy, or any procedure at home, they can continue to have those services. The policy also waives the restrictions to the provision of telehealth for Medicare and Medicaid, which has enabled members of the community to have access to their providers remotely, which obviously has helped not only to protect the patient and the doctors, but also to slow the spread of COVID-19. Additionally, this policy provides flexibility for healthcare providers to reduce or waive costs of sharing the telehealth visits paid by federal healthcare programs. Because these policies were created to meet the needs and to remove the barriers to care during the public health emergency, they will most likely expire as soon as the administration declares that we are not longer in a public health emergency. I feel that these policies are very essential, very important and essential to protect those with underlying medical conditions, which makes them at higher risk to COVID-19, but also that this policy have shown us that there is flexibility available to patients, not just during COVID, but also for everyday life, because like I said, not many of us are able to go places because we have mobility issues, or we don't drive, or we can't afford transportation. There's a lot of different factors that prevents patients from being able to receive medical care in person. So having telehealth services makes it more convenient and safer for patients at the moment, which is why many patients' organizations are advocating to extend these policies, the community home health and telehealth policy, beyond the public health emergency, and they are trying to make it permanently, because it would just be good for everybody to have, you know, access to their doctors and to their medical care safely from their home during, not just during the pandemic, but beyond that. It makes it more convenient. So please try to help us to extend this policy. Talk to your members of Congress and tell them about the community home services and telehealth policy, and tell them to extend it, because this would just mean a more accessible way for patients to have access to their medical care. You've been listening to Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. This is Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. I'm your host, DJ Rare. I know there are a lot of things going on in the news right now, but something that has been on the news recently and a lot lately has caught my attention, and that is the debate about the possible repeal of the Affordable Care Act, or as a lot of people know it, Obamacare. Now, you might ask why that particular topic has caught my attention, and that is because, like many people, I have a pre-existing medical condition, so I've been following the case a little bit. If you don't know, or if you haven't seen the news, the Supreme Court, since 2018, the Supreme Court has been overseeing a case called California versus Texas. And this is a case in which the program is being challenged by Republican-led states because they feel that some of the provisions of the program are unconstitutional. Now, I know, I'm sure that most of you guys have heard about the Affordable Care Act, or even have health insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. But I'm going to remind you guys of what this program is all about. So this program has three provisions, or three primary goals. And the first goal is to make affordable health insurance available to more people. And the way they do this is that they provide consumers with subsidized or premium tax credit that lowers costs for households that have income between 100% or 400% of the federal poverty level. The second goal is to expand the Medicaid program to cover all adults with incomes with an income below 138% of the federal poverty line. And the last goal is to support innovative medical care delivery methods designed to lower the cost of healthcare. So under the Affordable Care Act, many people have been able to obtain affordable health insurance, and it has also expanded the Medicaid program. Now, under this law, also, they provide protection to individuals with pre-existing medical conditions like myself and 153 million other people with pre-existing medical conditions. And also, it provides protection to individuals to allow them to be under their parents' medical insurance until they are 26 years old. And the reason why this particular this topic has caught my attention since it's been in the news lately is because I was talking to a mom of a boy who has the same condition as I do, and he's a minor, but she was worried about the fact that, you know, they're reappealing the program, and she was worried about losing health coverage for her son, because our treatment, our medical treatment, is very expensive. So I don't know how we would be able to cover it without health insurance. But currently, the Trump administration is pushing to end the program in a moment that I feel is so critical for our nation. I mean, we have a global pandemic, a public health emergency, and a lot of people have lost their job. And because they have lost their jobs, they have also lost their health insurance. So I just think, like, what is the Trump administration thinking trying to end a program that provides medical insurance to people? Is the Supreme Court rules in favor of ending the Affordable Care Act? Research has found that 27 million of Americans will lose their insurance. 27 million. And 53 million, like I said, 53 million individuals with pre-existing medical conditions will be without insurance. 53 million of individuals with pre-existing medical conditions will be without insurance. And this is not even counting. This is not even counting the already 30 million of people who currently do not have insurance. 30 million people that don't have insurance either because they can't afford medical insurance, or because they don't qualify, or because their immigration status doesn't allow them to have medical insurance. But that's 30 million people. And research has found that that number is gonna double by next year. So with a pandemic, I mean, with a virus that we don't even have a vaccine, and the Trump administration is thinking about ending a program that is so critical at this moment. Because it's a given. It's a given that COVID-19 is still going to be around for next year. So how will 60 million of uninsured people be able to get tested when they need to? How will they be able to pay for the treatment if they get sick with COVID-19? And if there's a vaccine, how are they going to be able to pay for it? And how are they, I mean, there's so many questions, so many how, what's going to happen, you know, now that we still have COVID-19? These are the questions that are going through my head as I watch the ongoing debate and as I follow the case. And I hope that many of you guys are also asking yourself those questions, because it's important, you know. This law is not perfect. This law is not perfect by any means, but it has greatly expanded medical coverage for millions of people. And taking it away right now can be deadly to a lot of people. And I feel like if the Trump administration had a plan to replace it, maybe I wouldn't be so worried about it. But they don't even have a plan. They don't have any, they don't even have a choice for us to compare, or, you know, to make an informed decision. So I feel that until they have a plan, they should stop trying to end the program. The only program that is offering any sort of medical coverage to people in a public health emergency, and to cover, you know, other medical needs. So, Mr. President, if you have another plan, another affordable health insurance plan, please give it to us, provide it to us, give us the detail. I'll support it. It's a plan that's gonna be beneficial to all of us. You were listening to Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu, the official radio station of Dominican University. Welcome back to Rarely Disabled on Penguin Radio, the official radio station of Dominican University of California. I'm your host, DJ Rare. We have all watched for months as the Republicans and Democrats fight with each other about certain issues and topics throughout the year, including COVID-19, the protests, tax, the economy, healthcare, and now also voting for the election. Now, they have suggested that we do vote by mail for this year because of COVID-19, obviously, you know, to protect everybody and also to slow the spread of the virus. And as I've been listening to the different debates about it and, you know, the arguments of both parties, I wonder to myself, is this an accessible choice? I'm always looking on ways to make things more accessible. You know, that's my thing. But I was wondering, was vote by mail more accessible? So I decided to do a little research about the advantages and disadvantages of voting by mail. And this is what I found. For the most part, vote by mail has long been supported by disabled voters. And this is because for many years, they have faced many barriers that prevents or makes it difficult for them to vote. That's not anything new. We all know that individuals with disabilities face many challenges when voting. One of the biggest challenges when trying to vote is or are inaccessible polling places. Currently, only 17% of polling places nationwide are fully accessible. What? How can that be possible? How can in a country that has 61 million people with a disability, only 17% of polling places are fully accessible? That makes no sense at all. And that just says that we are really falling behind on making things accessible for individuals. Other challenges that I found that individuals face are lack of transportation options to and from the polling places, non-functioning electronic voting units. Sometimes they're not even like turned on or ready for when the individual with disability comes to vote. And also, I found that most of the polling workers don't have any training on working with individuals with disabilities. So those are the challenges, some of the challenges that individuals with disabilities face when trying to vote. The benefits that I have found for vote by mail are convenience, obviously. It's very convenient because you can fill out your ballot from the safety of your own home. It doesn't cost you any money because you don't have to pay for transportation or other inconveniences to get to the polling place. Your health, obviously, it reduces the risk for those with underlying medical conditions. And then time, because since you are voting from home, you have more time to fully look at the ballot and read it and, you know, make an informed decision. When you're in the polling place, for the most part, it's crowded.